I'll call to order the Senate Interim Committee on General Government, Consumer, and Small Business Protection. Colleagues, today is May 23rd, 2012, and we're convened for the purposes of an informational meeting in this interim committee to review state public contracting on Oregon-owned, minority-owned, women-owned, and emerging small businesses. We'll also hear an update on House Bill 3000, the Buy Oregon First Bill, and get an update on some of the state entities that do indefinite quantity contracts, otherwise known as price agreements, on architectural and engineering services. So that being said, why don't I hand it over to you, Jan, and you can tell us how we should proceed first.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the people who have been invited to testify have been told how long that they have. Several agencies are bringing more than one person, but they're limited to 15 minutes to talk on the first topic. And you have before you some printed materials that were provided ahead of time. On the first topic, we do have a panel at the end that are representing the minority interests. And on the middle topic, we'll be hearing from Representative Clem and the effect of House Bill 3000. And at the end, it's the follow-up to the conversation that the committee has had on a number of occasions dealing with price agreements and architectural and engineering contracts, and it will be a time to hear from the Oregon University System on their price agreements.
Great, thank you. Could we please bring up Cheryl Myers and Diane Lancaster? And they've got 15 minutes also?
They have 15 minutes each.
Okay.
Good morning, Chair Shields and Senators Rosenbaum and Dingfelder. Nice to see you again. Jan, thank you again for all your assistance. Good morning. I'm absolutely pleased to be here. I believe you have a copy of our annual report. It is our first annual report. And if you have not seen, if you've seen previous reports from this office, this looks a lot different. And so in the executive summary, which is, I believe, page the third page in, really those are the highlights. So I have held this role for a little over a year now, and pleased to bring you this information. So you can see on the grid there, pretty much bottom line, the number of agencies that were covered under the old executive order. And so in 2010, for instance, there were just under $20 million of contracts issued to minority and women-owned firms. But out of 11 agencies, only 5 participated, which means 6 did not issue any contracts. And I'm pleased to report that in 2011, we have over $33 million that was awarded, and 12 of 12 agencies participated. So that to me is the most encouraging, that we had agencies engaged and involved and very intentional. And just as we're ramping that up, the very pleased that the governor signed a new executive order increasing that number from 12 to 21 agencies. And yes.
Senator Dingfelder.
Thank you. I have a quick question on that, Cheryl. What is the criteria that's being used for a reporting agency and thus expanding it? And so what is the criteria for whether they're included or not in reporting and engaging in a
I don't know what the criteria was for the prior executive order, because I wasn't here. I believe they were large agencies that would contract, typically have contracting opportunities. But in conjunction with Frank Garcia, our diversity and inclusion director, we have formed a diversity and inclusion agency head kitchen cabinet, and we have pulled together, we meet quarterly with 26 of our largest agencies. And Legislative Council, for instance, doesn't do a lot of contracting, but so that's why the new executive order covers 21 agencies to help frame that piece.
Mm-hmm. Just a quick follow-up. I was curious if it was like a monetary cutoff, you know, that they had to be contracting out a certain amount or a certain percentage, because I would think that would be helpful just to know what the criteria is.
Yeah, and again, the criteria is we're already meeting with these 26 agency heads. Some of those don't have their own semi-independent boards, so OUS and Lottery and OLCC, for instance. While they're not included in the executive order, they have voluntarily agreed to provide information.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
And Cheryl, could you identify yourself for the
record? Sorry. Cheryl Myers, Director of Economic and Business Equity for Governor Kitzhaber's office.
Thank you. please continue.
Great. And so that is the bottom line piece again, you know, having 12 agencies and now having 21 agencies to work with this year. As you go through the report, there's more detailed information in regard to the work of our office. The Opportunity Register and Clearinghouse Program is primarily to be certain that certified firms are notified of opportunities. So agencies, when they issue contracts over $5,000, between $5,000 and $150,000, they notify our office so that we can, again, do additional outreach other than it just being on the Oregon Procurement Information Network. So a new deputy director, Kimberly Sutton, who is in the audience, who is on her third day, and very pleased to have her. She brings a wealth of information, especially on the federal side. She was Bruce Watts' right-hand person at TriMet. So she brings great knowledge of community as well as really the practices of creating great opportunities for our disadvantaged business enterprises. So we did a lot of communication and outreach. If you take a look at page 5, there's a web shot of our web page. When we arrived, there was a photo of the Capitol and, you know, a very few minor things. But what we really wanted to create was an additional clearinghouse of resources for small businesses. So if you go through our web, if you have a chance to look at it, I'd love for you to, in case you ran into business owners in your districts that could utilize this information. We have over 30 links to access to capital, information on how to be certified not only in Oregon but in our surrounding states, with the feds, any other agencies you're aware of, like Port of Portland, that have their own registration links. We have those there. We've partnered with Google, who is providing free websites to Oregon businesses, and they have a wonderful process to be able to do that. We have, if someone's interested in participating in the Cool Schools programs that are going to hopefully be happening this summer, the interest form is located on our website, again, strengthening that connection to certified firms. There's a link from the Department of Energy website if people are looking at Cool Schools, directly back to our website. We have bios from our staff from this past year. We did very strategic outreach and really tried to connect with other agencies that were maybe not able to do outreach because of budget cuts. So we would carry information for additional agencies. And we met with a ton of people. And didn't do as much statewide travel as we'd like, just to be fiscally prudent, but we made the most of the trips that we made and, again, carried additional information. Governor's Marketplace last year was on the snow day of the year where all the schools were closed. And despite that, we had a little over 300 people attend, and we're pleased with that. We just held the second one. This year was actually the 10th. Governor Kitzhaber created Governor's Marketplace in his earlier administration. But we were pleased to have over 400 people attend, and people have been continuing to say how valuable it was as a networking opportunity and that ability to meet procurement staff directly and begin those relationships, which is important. So we were out in 16 communities during our roadshow, from south to east to central to the north coast and mid coast. We have been everywhere. Someone asked me one time how I can be everywhere, and I said, well, I said yes to Governor Kitzhaber, and I got my, you know, standard government clone, of course. But we've made a really tremendous effort to be engaged with the community at large. And the community at large not only includes certified firms, it also includes large private sector businesses who could contract with those firms. It includes additional government entities that could also contract. I was in Medford and met with the procurement manager there, and she wasn't aware there was a certified firm list, and she was thrilled to find out about it. She said, you mean I can find local people just by doing this search? Absolutely. And so, again, heightening that awareness of what's possible and creating the information to, I guess, play a bit of a matchmaker. And so moving along, just a lot of stuff. I read this and decided I should be more tired. And I know that Diane's going to talk a little bit about ORPIN, the Oregon Procurement Network, and the changes that are coming there. I'm really thrilled the governor convened a minority contracting advisory group, and so we'll be meeting occasionally with the governor to talk about things that are of importance to the minority contracting community directly, not filtered, you know, completely unfiltered, and it was a great meeting. From the Diversity and Inclusion Kitchen Cabinet that I meet with Frank Garcia, I've asked each of those agencies to provide me a procurement person. So really want to work on the leadership perspective as well as really on the ground. And so we've met a couple of times now and are going to be meeting again shortly with procurement advisory to talk about RFP language, to talk about best practices, and to really unbundle and unsilo our practices when it comes to certified firms and procurement.
Cheryl, yes. Those meetings with the advisory council, I assume, will be ongoing. Could you let us know when those are so we can let the communities in our district know?
Right. They have been a bit select, just so they're not, they haven't been open meetings, but if you have people in your districts that you'd like to participate, we've tried to keep them a bit on the intimate side, because otherwise they get very large and no one really has a chance to hear or speak.
Sure, I can appreciate that. I can let people know that they would just be participants. But
absolutely.
I mean, they're obviously open. They're public meetings.
Yes.
So.
Yes, absolutely. Wonderful. And so you have some charts as well that talk about really where we're at. We have a little over 3,200 firms certified, and I believe we were at 2,800 when I began a little over a year ago. My goal is to dramatically change that over the next several years. You can see by county, and then I think these maps on page 16 are also very helpful that help identify throughout the state where our minority businesses are located, women-owned businesses. And we've been fortunate to have an intern to be able to do some of this work for us to create these maps.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, Senator Dinkfelder.
Okay, thank you. Cheryl, first of all, this is quite an improvement over past years, and I really commend you for the amount of work and effort and the support that you and the governor has put into this. One of the things I thought about be really helpful is, as a follow-up to what Senator Shields talked about, is each of us has a newsletter that goes out to our constituents. And it would be really helpful if you can maybe put together something. I would love to put something in my next newsletter about the work that you're doing, a link, and get the word out. You know, I speak to chambers in my community. So it would be helpful if you could package up something that we could include to educate our constituents about the work that you're doing and also the resources that's available. Because, as you know, we have thousands of small businesses within at least our communities, you know, can talk about in Portland and I'm sure in rural areas as well. This information would be really valuable.
Wonderful. That's one of our efforts coming up this year, is to really work, especially on the professional services side. It seems like, not that we don't need to be certain to certify more people involved in construction, but before I was in this role, I would think of contracting with the government being more roads and bridges and buildings and things, but it's IT, it's transcription, it's translation, it could be contract phlebotomists, it could be so many additional vendors that and small businesses, and as larger companies have shed their employees, many of them have started their own businesses. So again, it's another way for people to be found. So the goal with these maps is to eventually have them in a place where you could actually click on an area and find certified firms. We're not there yet, but at least we have them graphically depicted. Another project that we haven't launched and isn't in here yet, but will be up shortly, is as I traveled around the state, people would say, well, where are the opportunities? Where are the physical locations? Is there a Department of Employment here? Is there a lottery office here? You know, would they need landscaping? Would they need painting? Would they need translation services? And so we're working on a map right now of all the physical locations of state offices around the state, which I think will be also helpful. So you have detail about the last 3 years of the aspirational targets for those 11, now 12 agencies. And then you have industry clusters showing via the five ODOT regions of where certified firms and their categories that are there, as well as the new executive order from the governor that moves us to 21 agencies and also very inclusive language for all agencies to voluntarily participate. So we're excited and very passionate about the work we're doing, and we have a big year ahead of us. So we look to continue much greater participation by our certified firms.
Great. Cheryl, I really appreciate the report breaking down how much of the contracts are going to minority and women-owned businesses. A lot of times ESBs are also grouped in there, and it gives a different perception on how we're doing in this front. So I think just starting off with what the baseline is was quite helpful. I mean, out of billions of dollars the state spends, I think we're still well below when it comes to equal opportunity of where we should be, but at least we know where the facts are, and I appreciate the advances the governor has made, and let's keep at it.
Thank you. Additionally, this year, while we're not setting aspirational targets, we are also collecting data on contracts given to emerging small business, because I anecdotally hear it all over the board, and we don't have any data, so beginning this year, we'll also have data, which will be helpful. Thank you.
Good morning, Senator Shields, members of the committee. Diane Lancaster from the DAF State Procurement Office. Pleasure to be here this morning. It has been a delight to work with Cheryl for this past year or so, and you can hear some of the things that we have been partnering on. You have a brief presentation in your materials called Opportunities in Public Contracting, and I thought I would highlight a few thoughts in here, and I think I've got it on the screen. I'm not sure if I'm. Because you got it printed out.
Okay. Yeah, but for people in the audience
so I want
to see it.
The, too. It's the top one, I think. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, that one. Great.
Okay, great. Oh, and for the audience, our report is available on our website.
Cheryl, while they're setting that up, I did have a question about the aspirational goals. Mm-hmm. So how are those set? I mean, are you looking at, obviously, you're probably looking at past performances and say we're doing better. I mean, you're looking at other states and how we compare with other states and what, because, I mean, I noticed that they also range, quite a bit. And
yes, they do.
Yes.
And so what we did is we provided to each agency a listing of all the contracts that they issued the previous year, and then this industry cluster, it allowed them to see where certified firms lived and operated so that they could say, we have, 11 firms that are residential remodelers, so housing could look at that and say if we're going to, we have a project coming up. So we left it to the procurement staff to set those aspirational targets. Mm-hmm. And really it's a matter of leadership from my perspective. I just got DAS's aspirational target for this year, and it's 15%. So there obviously aren't teeth in this because we don't have a statewide disparity study, but it does send a very big signal. I've talked to so many procurement staff who say, my director has stopped by and has asked specifically, how are we doing on these measures? What are we doing on these measures? And that doesn't sound like that's always been the case. And so, again, moving that level to a higher priority level, I think, has made all the difference.
Yeah. And just to follow up, are you going to be adjusting these goals annually?
Yes. With great encouragement.
Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah, I know, I understand you don't want to set them too high so they're unrealistic.
Right.
However, they are a goal for a purpose. Right?
Well, and the other piece, nonprofits are not eligible to be certified. So particularly in our health and human services, are certain vendors that are not eligible to be counted as a certified firm. That they may be a minority-owned firm, they may be a woman-owned firm, but they are not eligible for certification. So that's also something that I'm mindful of. But that doesn't mean, as I look through contracts, that there aren't lots of folks that either could be certified or certified firms that could be utilized.
Cheryl, you brought up a good point about there's no disparity study for DAS. It's something that we've worked on in the past that the agency was resistant to. Has the governor's office thought about implementing a disparity study for other agencies outside of ODOT?
In the current fiscal climate, that's not something that's been significantly prevalent, but one of the pieces that I want to prep for when fiscal components are a little easier to look at is being certain right now that we certify and are utilizing ferns, because that would affect the disparity study. So if we, for instance, right now I tried to pull for catering the other day, and I talked to someone here last night at a networking event, you're a caterer, you should get certified. Because the availability piece is important in a disparity study. So we want to be able to look fairly when that time comes and when those studies are conducted, that we have firms that are appropriately able to participate in that study. So the availability is incredibly important. And at 3,200 firms, I don't know that we have, I'm not confident we have the kind of firm participation that we need to have.
But you're not going to be able to set hard goals without a disparity study,
exactly.
Is that correct?
Right. Exactly.
Well, I know that the governor's office and BAM are putting together the budget as we speak, and I think that noting the correlation between minority and women-owned firms and them actually being Oregon firms compared to out-of-state firms, mm-hmm. If you had a disparity study that would allow us to have some hard goals, that well might be a great economic development strategy and more than pay for itself, mm-hmm. if it gave us the muscle to then provide some contracts to more minority and women-owned firms. So what I've found in this process is it's a lot easier to pass something in the governor's budget than it is to force something down the executive branch's throat. And so if there's a way that we could get that into through BAM and through DAS, I think those of us who are interested in this topic and the public sure would appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, to segue from Cheryl's remarks, again, Diane Lancaster from the DAS State Procurement Office, really one of our fundamental functions is to provide a marketplace. And the marketplace is where those 3,200 firms and thousands of other firms come to look for opportunities and buyers and sellers to get together. We have the Orpen logo. Orpen, thankfully, we trademarked the name. It isn't, they're very expensive to do. So Orpen, even though we're going to replace the current software, the Orpen name will stay the same. And we think that's important because people are used to it and can find it. Orpen supplier history, as Cheryl said, we have been working with her and doing our own efforts to make sure that Oregon businesses know that Orpen is available to them, and we are seeing solid growth. As of December, we had almost 54,000 registered business addresses in Orpen. 56% of those were Oregon businesses, and we have as of May 15th, we had 3,176 MSWIB certified businesses in Orpen. So we know we're capturing most of those 3,200 businesses that Cheryl was talking about. Orpen is, we believe, it's web-based, it's convenient, transparent, and even in its current status, it works well, and it's free. As of this week, there were 37 government agencies that had solicitations posted, 13 from local government. And local government participation is very important because they provide many opportunities for certified businesses. So, again, we're anxious to continue having more and more solicitations posted on Orpen. And as of the day we pulled this sample, there were 153 opportunities valued from $5,000 on up that were posted on Orpen. One of the things that we've been doing to help Cheryl's initiatives and to meet the spirit and intent of the legislative work is to do what we can to label opportunities, and you'll note that here's a label for ESB. As Cheryl has pointed out, we can't specifically set aside a minority opportunity or a woman-owned opportunity, but we can certainly flag emerging small business opportunity because that is race and gender neutral. We also have the ability to put a Buy Oregon tag, and I'll speak about that a little later when we talk about the in-state product and service preference under House Bill 3000. But it's interesting because when something says Buy Oregon, Oregon certified firms also benefit. And so we're hoping, again, to continue to help people find each other in the marketplace. We set up, for your information, or your staff, if you'd like, this is a current access. It's set up for you or your staff to go in and take a look at ORPIN. And so that access code and log password are available to you currently. We've had that refreshed and set up for your, just for you to go in and browse if you'd like to. ORPIN, again, while our ability to split out by types of awards is still difficult, and Cheryl remarked on this, we do know some statistics that come out of ORPIN. There are thousands of contracts that are reported annually through the system, and we had over 4,000 contracts awarded out of that were reported in the fiscal year ending June 30 of 2011. Out of that, 2,900 or 74% were awarded to businesses with Oregon addresses. And again, we think this is a good sign. There is a significant amount of those dollars that are going to Oregon companies. And, of course, the thing that jumps out at you on this update is the third piece, which looks, it's 58% of the total contract dollars, but it's a drop. And, of course, I wanted to be sure and be able to answer your immediate question about why that would be such a drop. I have had a complete, and again, our reporting capabilities are somewhat limited, but I've had a complete report run of that $4.61 billion. You'll note the difference in that $2.26 billion awarded the year before, and then a significant, almost a doubling of the actual contract awards. I went through the report myself, and what I think we are seeing is a significant amount of dollars reported in ORPIN due to the ARRA, the federal stimulus programs, because this includes data from early 2010. Also, the Owen Project, I toted up over $300 million in Owen Project work on the interoperability system, radio system. In addition, ODOT has been very active with bridge construction and road construction, so I don't have definite figures, but we think that's why. But the good news is $4.61 billion of contracting flowed through ORPIN. The legislature last session in 2011 authorized us to replace the software, and we are underway. That program is being replaced, and our go-live target will be this fall. I'll look forward to reporting back on how that's going. And the new software will be much more expansive than the current ORPIN system. We'll have better reporting capability. I think we're going to have significantly improved reporting capability for minority, women, emerging small business efforts. We'll be looking also at disabled veteran-owned businesses. You know, we'll be able to really start segregating those categories so we can see what's going on in that marketplace. I have a few slides here just for your information because, again, we want to make sure that we're being creative. We have over 365 state price agreements that are currently in effect. And the important fact on this is that these are all advertised. They get best value because it's aggregated volume. But the important part here, I think, for today's conversation is, again, this tremendous participation that is coming up from the local governments. Here's what the money gets spent on. You'll see that, about 60% of it is telecommunications and information technology. So again, Cheryl has been, it's been wonderful to work with her to start getting a handle on where the minority women and emerging small business firms are focusing their work, and how can we match that up with what the state and local governments are actually buying. So we're trying to start mining that to get, to get better matches. Here's just a snapshot of local government spend. This is a $190 million snapshot for last year, and you'll notice that out of the total spend, over half of it came from local government. And so again, strong participation, which is very good for the certified firms, because that's the point, is to bring those opportunities to their attention and get them engaged. Now, for our work, we have been trying to, Cheryl mentioned this, we have been trying to work with many of the larger firms like OfficeMax, Staple, Waxy Janitorial, to break down their offerings and work with them and promote the notion that they have minority women, emerging small business certified firms providing supplies through their catalogs, through their sales to Oregon agencies. And we are seeing some good headway with that. Again, when we go to a new ORPIN system, I hope to be able to give some decent statistics about that work, because it's not direct award, but it's working with a larger corporation and being able to effectively market your products or your services through a larger company. And we think there's great promise there. One very successful price agreement is for information technology managed services. This is something that now has been in place for about 5 or 6 years, and we've had some pretty good growth. It is highly successful for the certified firms, and I think the major reason for that is that this is actually a company, we hire a company that provides a total wraparound service to the smaller firms. They have an office in Portland. The company currently running this program for us is called Covendus, and Covendus staffs this office. Small firms come in. The Covendus company has software. They take opportunities off of ORPIN. They take them directly from agencies, and they put them out in their software for these firms to be notified of and to participate on. So in this situation, we've got almost 37% of the work orders going to certified firms, and even though our spend was lower this year because of budgetary constraints on agencies, there was still 44%, about $2.5 million of those orders went to certified firms. Now, this is for staff augmentation. It's for the programmer, the database administrator. It's for the information technology types of services. It is also for the smaller projects, so that a small software development firm or a small consulting firm that is certified, and there are many of them, is going to have a lot better success, I think, working with this program. Other state business opportunities, again, we are trying to break out some of our larger efforts like lawn and garden equipment, and in this case, instead of just one major manufacturer, we awarded 14. And while several of them have resellers, distributors in Oregon, we actually had an Oregon small business that was successful at achieving a price agreement all by themselves. So again, by breaking out, we're hoping to encourage Oregon small businesses that are attached to larger manufacturers. The same thing with tires. We have a major contract now with Les Schwab, Goodyear, Michelin, Bridgestone, Firestone, and since each major manufacturer has a distribution network, this now can include many small businesses who can offer that manufacturing pricing, but offer it out in Burns or John Day and give the government agencies same kind of pricing that they could get here in the I-5 corridor. So again, and then finally, we wanted to just give you each a brief snapshot of the types of local government and not-for-profit agencies in your districts that are active and using, registered and using ORPIN. And so we just went ahead and provided those that little bit of data for the members of the committee. Finally, I'd like to comment that we have been delighted to work with Cheryl, putting together the outreach activities. As Cheryl said, we've participated in many of the roadshows, many of the presentations, the conferences. Many hands make light work. That's just the bottom line. And so when we work together with Cheryl and the other agencies, we're able to make these kinds of outreach happen and make them happen economically. Upcoming outreach activities, again, just for your information, we have some upcoming opportunities here in June. one at Chemeketa Center for Business and Industry in Salem, another here with the federal contracting helpers, the GCAP people. They are an assistance program for federal contracts, and we'll be bringing that program to Salem and Portland. So thank you. I just wanted to give you a sense of where we are with the statewide price agreements, and particularly the work that we think is bringing opportunities to the forefront so that firms know that they're there and agencies can make matches. So again, it's been a pleasure to work with Cheryl and be creative about putting together some of these ideas. So thank you.
Thanks, Diane. Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosenbaum.
So I know you talked, Diane, about the ORPIN name, and and these conferences are great. And are there other ways that businesses hear about this? What do you do to publicize this?
Senator Rosenbaum, I think we've touched on this a couple of times this morning, and it is a grassroots outreach. You know, Cheryl has said she needs to be cloned because there are so many events. And what I have found in my own work over many years in attending events and working with this is that many firms either they need a personal touch. They need to know something personally. And so ORPIN is great, and we have to have it, but we've got to help people know it's there. And to help these small firms know it's there and know how to use it, frankly, one of the best ways is to go out there with Cheryl and with ODOT's folks and literally get out in the communities. That, is even today, is still, we believe, the second most effective way, the first being having really solid and great technology that's easy and user-friendly, that doesn't turn people away. That's really important. So that's the personal relationships, and then, of course, the technology.
Great. Thanks.
thank you very much. I think it was in 2005 or 2007 session. I think it might have been 2005. There was a bill that Senator Gordley worked on and that I helped a little bit in the House that would require any contract over $5,000, I think, to be... that the commissions needed to be made aware of it, the commission for Oregon Commission for Women, Black Affairs, Hispanic Affairs, etc., Asian Affairs. Is my recollection correct that that's how that bill was designed to work?
Senator Shields, you're very close. The bill, when it ultimately was, and actually I think a law was actually passed out of that, and I'm thinking, I can't recall, 5 or 7, but the end result was that agencies are not only to report the opportunity over $5,000 both in ORPIN and to Cheryl's Clearinghouse program at the first, they are to come back and report what happened, and they are to report that. We've offered that in ORPIN so that we know what happened, did you contract with whom, and for how much. The commissions, I don't recall, sir, there may have been discussion, but the final passage didn't technically say report to these different boards. But I do believe that Cheryl's Clearinghouse work certainly will support that, and so that they're aware. Again, it's this clearinghouse trying to put buyer and seller together. So everywhere that we can find that kind of connector, and if we're not really pushing that out to those folks, we'll make a note and we'll make sure we do that, because that's another area that we need to, get some information to.
Could you do me a favor and respond to the professional staff, do the research on what that bill was?
We'll be happy to do that.
I think I mentioned it in my voter's pamphlet statement, if you're looking for a shortcut.
Okay.
back in from 2006.
Okay. I'll make sure we go back.
And just give a paragraph or two to Jan and let us know that that's happening, and or if it's not, that's fine too, but we just,
yeah.
I want to make sure that that we remind the agencies that they're supposed to do that part.
Very
of the,
good.
Of the
thank
statute.
You, Senator.
Thank you.
We'll work with Jan on that.
All right. Great. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Could we please bring up Michael Cobb from ODOT?
And Clyde will come with
us. And Clyde.
Or maybe not.
Okay. morning.
Well,
Senator Shields and committee members. I'm Michael Cobb, manager, Office of Civil Rights, Oregon Department of Transportation. Okay. And I'm here today to basically respond to a question that was put forth, asking what significant policy changes have you made to any of your programs within the last 2 years? And I just might add that while all of our programs are doing very well and moving forward, the only program where there was literally a significant policy change is within the ESB program, Emerging Small Business Program. As a little background, the ESB program was created in 1998 by statute. And its purpose was for contracts not to exceed $100,000 to provide opportunities for those small firms to remove some of the barriers and to give them projects or contracts that they could bid on that was more within their reach. And over the years, the program was pretty much centrally managed by my office. We helped select the projects. We administered the budget. We looked at project execution and followed the contracts pretty much from my office. And while over the years, last biennium, we did successfully award 167 contracts for a contract value of $7.2 million for last biennium, we still were not satisfied. We felt that there had to be a more all-inclusive, diverse method of getting the information out and getting these contracts into the hands of small businesses, ESB firms across the state. So in 2011, we widely revamped the program. We decentralized it in that the budget, while it is still overseen by my office, we divided the money among the ODOT regions across the state, and we basically said to the ODOT project management and operations management people there, you will be responsible for identifying the projects within your region, within these constraints. You know, you want safety type projects, public improvement, etc. But you identify, you know where the small firms are far better than we do, way out in Region 5 as an example, rather as opposed to my office here in Salem trying to find the firms. You know where they are out there. You also know the needs of the community. How could these ESB dollars better benefit the communities where you are? You know this better than we do. So we decentralized, and the budgets now are managed by the regions. They also identify the projects. They put together a list of projects for each biennium. That whole project list, of course, is evaluated by the regional manager, and then it bubbles up to the program directors, and then obviously my office at some point does indeed bless it and say yay or amen and move forward. Along with that, we found that there was a much greater interest in the project execution. So we now have the project staff in the regions becoming more involved with the program management. The project management is no longer just an exercise to quote-unquote move ESB funding. We find that there's a greater interest in the types of projects that are coming across. For this biennium, we anticipate that we will have awarded 189 contracts for a total contract value of somewhere between $9 and $11 million. That's what we're anticipating by the time the biennium is over. Again, the most significant part here is the training aspect. You saw in the charts here by Diane Lancaster some of the outreach programs and things that we run. We do conduct these around the state on the road shows, as we've been calling them, where we go into the communities. It's very important that we reach out and touch them firsthand and explain to them what projects and what contracts are coming down the line. We also go to our organizations like OWAMI and NAMCO, and we meet around the state wherever we can to talk about these are ODOT opportunities coming up for the ESB program. So looking at the decentralization in terms of responding to your question, that is the most significant policy change that we've made within the last 2 years. We are constantly seeking new and innovative ways to change things and to increase opportunities for small firms, pushing the envelope wherever we can. But again, for the last 2 years, this is pretty much the program. Any questions?
I have a couple of comments. One thing that I want to have happen by the time the next legislative session comes around, because we're going to hold a similar hearing about this in January, is to be able to compare apples to apples over time, because we don't want to simply beat up a state agency. We want to encourage them to do better. So when we come back in January, if you could go back and take a look at the testimony given on February 9th, 2011, which ODAC gave some very detailed testimony that included the top 10 contracts that the agency received, and also what percentage of those were minority women-owned businesses. And I think none of the top 10 contracts were to minority firms. Looks like three were to women-owned firms. So just to report back on how that's proceeding, again, apples to apples
okay.
January. This is very helpful. Again, we need the baseline. We need to know what the truth is, and even if it's not what we would like it to be, to encourage you to do better and not to
sure.
necessarily beat you up for not doing what you should be. So I appreciate your testimony. Any questions for Michael? Thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome.
Can we please bring up Stella Transu and Gloria Anderson? Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Chair Shields. I'm Stella Transu with the Administrator of the Office of Contracts and Procurement for Department of Human Services. We support both the contract activities for Department of Human Services and Oregon Health Authority.
Good morning, Chair Shields, committee members. My name is Gloria Maria Anderson, and I'm the Director of the Office of Equity and Multicultural Services for the Department of Human Services.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning. I'm going to be giving just the highlights of some of the activities that we continue to pursue with contracting with women-owned, minority-owned, and emerging small businesses for Oregon Health Authority and Department of Human Services. A lot of our contract dollars go out based on Oregon Revised Statutes to counties and intergovernmental entities, and also to specific licensed facilities, entities that are required. But of the remaining dollars, we continue to promote contracting with the minority women-owned and emerging small businesses. One of the things that we continue to do is have a presence at the Governor's Marketplace and at vendor and trade shows. One of the things that we have found, it's important not only to have the contracting staff there, but also the programming staff that are intimately involved with the contracting possibilities, the service needs of our agency. So that has really worked well for us to have our program staff there, and they're able to answer questions and talk about the opportunities that may be coming forward. We continue also to write lots of low-dollar short forms, as we call them, for child welfare services. These are not generally posted on the ORPIN system because they're under $5,000, but we do promote certification of these firms. Most of them aren't certified, but appear to be potentially able to be certified. We have what we call a program users group, where the program staff that are really involved in contracting, we meet with them, and this is one of the items that we continue to promote and encourage people to check out certification, and we have a certification link on our web page so that people can find it easily and share, you know, information. The hospital replacement project, general contractor Hoffman Construction, they continue to promote minority and women-owned businesses and emerging small businesses. To date, 14.4% of the subcontracts have been awarded to certified firms. One of the other things that we've done recently is our office has reactivated our strategic initiative to collaborate with the Office of Economic and Business Equity. This was at the request of DHS and OHA leadership because they want to be actively involved in promoting contracts with certified firms. The two equity offices, the DHS Office of Equity and Multicultural Services and the OHA Office of Equity Inclusion, are involved in this committee, and what we have strategized some high-level activities. Some of them include workshops and focus groups, enhancing reporting requirements with prime contractors so we can determine the subs that are certified, and then enhancing our partnerships with local governments, because we do have lots of contracts with government entities. We know that they sub, and we would like to capture what that what those dollars then are contracted with certified firms. We also are very active in partnering with the with Cheryl's office. That's what we call it. It's easier. With the procurement group, we've been very involved in that. And Cheryl calls us, in fact, yesterday, called with a firm that was interested. And so, you know, we have some of those direct connections that work really well. And then some of the other strategies Gloria is going to speak to, specific strategies. I don't know if anyone has any questions before Gloria speaks specifically about the DHS strategies.
Could you try to find out for us what percentage of the 14.4 on the state hospital project are minority, and break down that 14.4 into minority women and emerging small businesses?
Absolutely.
See if Hoffman can do that for us.
Chair Shields and committee members. So the Office of Equity and Multicultural Services is tasked and charged with leading systemic change to really include a lens of diversity and inclusion and equity within everything that DHS does. So as Stella was saying, as we work in our supplier diversity and contracting matters, we have several high-level objectives within our initiatives. And those include, the first would be, and this would be for both DHS and OHA, is ensuring that our procurement increases opportunities for contracting with MWES certified firms, that service providers, that the workforce of those service providers are actually reflective of the demographics and diversity of the state of Oregon, and more specifically even to the clients and customers whom we serve. And the third one has to do with monitoring of the contracts to ensure that we are actually reaching equitable and the quality service delivery for the contractors, that services for which we're contracting. I think it's important also to really reference something that I think was mentioned earlier by Cheryl, is that in human services, the majority of our contracts are going to providers that are nonprofit and local government, so they would not qualify under the certified firms for MWES. So we would actually propose that perhaps a separate measure be created or adopted so that we could measure those nonprofits and local certified firms that we are contracting with. And these are the groups that typically are providing services to underserved minority communities, persons with disabilities, and women, and currently those are not really captured as a separate measure. For us, it's not only about increasing numbers, but really the quality of services that we're providing. Are they really equitable? Are they really reaching the outcomes that we're after? So currently, because of how we report our numbers, I think it gives a false illusion of the work that is happening within the agency, because we cannot include these as possible qualified firms. So we are working on a number of strategies, and our strategies really are looking slightly different between our two organizations. The objectives are the same. The strategies will be more specific to the needs of both OHA and DHS. So with that, I would say thank you so much for this opportunity, and really thank you for your commitment to service equity is what we're really about, and ensuring that those outcomes are going to be reached by all Oregonians. Questions?
I do have a question. You provided some very detailed testimony from 2011, and as you mentioned, Hoffman was your top contract, and then EDS, mostly counties, but there are two assisted living facilities, it seems, Marion Estates and Rosehaven Nursing Center, and those are $77 million and $66 million, respectively. Do you know if those are Medicaid payments, or is that a specific contract with DHS?
The majority of those would be Medicaid payments.
Okay.
And Marion Estates is no longer on our top 10, so it's shifted slightly, but not a lot.
Okay. you have a more current top 10? That's not part of your testimony?
Yes, and I have it for DHS and OHA.
Okay. Could you get that to Jan, and she can distribute it to the staff?
It's in your district now, I think.
Oh, it is?
Well, it used to be mine, I think.
Rose
Haven? I think so. I'll take a look.
They're based out of... All right. Can you tell... Do you know much about Rose Haven Nursing Center, or where they're located?
No, I don't know that, but I can certainly give you additional information.
Yeah, I just pulled it up on the web. I think they're in Roseburg, but they've got facilities throughout the state. Okay, any other questions? Thank you very much. And again, keep going back to your 2011 testimony, if you could be prepared to update that come January.
Okay.
Apples to apples. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Tammy Dorman, Department of Corrections. I think we're back on track. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Senator Shields and the committee. My name is Tammy Dorman. I'm the Assistant Director for General Services at Department of Corrections. Since we were here in 2011, we've been working really hard. Our percentages were very low, and they have been low. You know, we have a lot of work, and we're a general funded agency, so it's hard to have committees to help us and do things like some of the other agencies. But in the last couple years, we have been working really hard, and we have participated with the governor's marketplace, and this year we helped with the planning. We also took our construction project managers down with our procurement people to the governor's marketplace so that the businesses could actually meet the people who are going to manage the projects. Our goal has been 1%, but in the first quarter of 2012, we were at 11% for minority women and emerging small businesses. So we've been working really hard. We have put a link for the certification information on our website for vendors so that they can get certified. We have even assigned one of our procurement people to work to assist firms so that they can get certified because sometimes they qualify, but they don't do the work to get certified, and so we can't count them. We have made sure that in our newsletters out to the department, we've made the executive order visible to everyone so everyone knows what we're working towards. And we have been also, if we have an under 5,000 procurement, we've actually been trying to work directly with minority and women and emerging small businesses because we can direct negotiate with them. So we try to get them to give us a quote that's, you know, we can use, and we work with them directly. We've also joined the Oregon Association of Minority Entrepreneurs so that we can have a networking opportunity, and our procurement manager and fiscal services administrator have been attending those meetings so that we can, you know, make some face-to-face connections with people so that when they have questions, they can call us directly and they have a face with a name. I guess I'll save the Buy Oregon stuff till the next part, but we've been working on that too.
Okay.
Do you have any questions?
Could you also break out for us the 11% going to MWESB?
We'll get
and
that
minority
to
women and emerging
Ms.
small businesses.
Okay.
And do we also have any data on how J.E. Dunn has done in minority women owned subcontracting?
We can work on that too.
That would be great if you can get that to the professional staff to distribute to the committee.
Okay.
And you know, I think that anything that the contractors can do to fill out the picture of how they're doing with their subcontracting, I
correct,
think would be important information for the legislature to know generally.
Right.
Did you have a question?
Well, just a follow-up, Mr. Chair, thank you. One was going to be, having worked for a very large engineering firm that I was just going to follow up, that it's really important to make sure that you know the folks who you're contracting with, making sure you're providing direction to them when they're doing their subcontracting. And I just want to reiterate how important that is that the chair mentioned. But I guess I feel a little fixated on goals today, but I think it's really important. I noticed in your memo you had said about you had a 1% aspirational goal and you actually came in at 11% for during the first quarter of 2012. So can you talk about the process that you're going to, for next year, adjust your aspirational goal? And, you know, I realize you don't want to have, obviously, a goal that's too high that you're not going to be able to meet on a regular basis, but can you talk about the type of feedback that you use in adjusting those goals?
So we, Senator Dingfelder and Senator Shields and the committee, we found that we weren't having good enough connections between the information and the certification database to our accounting system, and that our aspirational goal had been 1% in the past, but we think that probably our actual results were higher, and we found that in one case we did some research and they were in one of the quarters, but the information wasn't linked right, and we've done some work to link those two up now. We use the state accounting system, but we also have to use our own accounting system because of our big inventory needs and our inmate trust account, so we can't use it directly. So we've done some work to link those up, and while we believe that we could have a higher aspirational goal, we need to get a little more data for a couple more quarters. And also, we do believe that we have vendors that just haven't gotten certified because they're getting business. So sometimes they're not motivated to get certified if they're doing fine and getting business from the state. So that's why we've taken more of a proactive role in trying to get people certified. So I think as we get more data, and we're looking at it really closely every quarter, that we can increase our aspirational goals. We just we're a little concerned about not having good data to make that goal. And so, yes, we don't want to get too, you know, we don't want to make a goal that we can't meet at all, that it's way too high. But I think you'll see them change over the next year.
And I have one last question that's a combination of the discussion here is, does the goal, and maybe I missed this in your presentation or when Cheryl came up, does the goal reflect the rate of hiring of subcontractors by your major contractors? In other words, when we're just talking about making sure that the big firms are hiring subs that meet those qualifications, is that reflected in this, in the data that you're gathering?
Senator Dingfelder, Chair Shields, we have some challenges in, you know, again, capturing that data. We have written in all of our contracts that we encourage, we have preference for using subcontractors, but right now we don't have a great mechanism to capture that, because when you make the payment, you're making it to the main contractor. So we have to take a little thought on how we're going to do that. It's probably going to be an offline spreadsheet. How do we, with decreasing resources, keep track of, I mean, there's lots of things we have to keep track of that aren't systematic in systems. So we will explore how we could streamline that and get it captured.
So is it a part of your reporting requirement now for those major contractors? I mean, I would imagine if you're requiring them to do
it. Probably is, but okay. We haven't been capturing it. Okay. So
well, obviously, that's something that you guys need to
work on.
Yeah, because for these big contracts, that's a lot. I mean, I'm a former WBE, and I know, because that is a big way that we get WBE and other firms is through these large contracts, because it's a lot of work to go after, you know, for an individual firm, and they don't necessarily always have the liability insurance, which is a big issue. So making sure that we're capturing that, I think, is really important, because obviously, you know, we're trying to incentivize for these big firms for them to improve their practices.
And particularly if you could, I mean, I think the burden doesn't have to be on you. It could be on the big contractor to create the spreadsheet. And it doesn't have to be something that goes into some database.
Right.
But certainly J.E. Dunn, I'm sure, is very used to doing these kinds of reports for other state agencies like ODOT. And so if you, at minimum, I know that you know, perhaps we won't be building another prison in the near future, but if history is any guide, I'd put my money on building the prison, unfortunately. So if you could see if you could get them in particular to give us a report on how they've done on minority contracting, MW and ESB broken down into three different categories, I sure would appreciate that and ask them to get that to the professional staff over the next couple of months.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Thank
Any
you.
Other questions? Thanks for your testimony.
Okay.
All right, Hillary Bounds and David Hopps. And this is primarily going to be on IDIQ.
No, that'll come later.
Okay. Great. Hi. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Chair Shields, members of the committee. I'm Hillary Bounds. I'm the Director of Contracting and Purchasing for the Oregon University System. I oversee our MW ESB initiatives at the system level, and with me is David Hobbs, who's the Assistant Director for Contracts and Compliance at Portland State University. He administers the capital construction portion of their MW ESB initiatives at Portland State. So I'm going to start by giving sort of a background of our system, new policies, our initiatives, and our efforts, a little bit of data that I've presented to you in our slides, and then David and I will be available for obviously any questions that you have for follow-up, and then we'll speak further about our A&E contracts later on in the agenda. I've been at the Oregon University system for 2 years, and when I started, the board made it a very clear priority to myself and our campus staffs who coordinate our MW ESB initiatives that this is a very high priority to them, that they want to see new policies being created and also an ongoing continual improvement by the campuses, both in construction and goods and services. So how we've gone forward in addressing these goals and priorities is to continue doing the outreach that we've been doing for some years and really being focused on things that are successful and getting new contractors onto our campuses, which is something that specifically within these MW ESB goals the board has discussed, is getting new contractors and people who maybe first-time opportunities getting work on the campus. Then, in addition to outreach, we've also developed a new policy, which I'll speak about in more detail later on in the presentation. So on this first page, or page two, as the page... On here you'll see, this is not an exhaustive list of our outreach. We have seven public campuses that each of them have their own outreach initiatives that are very involved in and are unique to the communities to which they're involved. But this is a little sampling of just what we've done in the last year and how we can make face-to-face connections in the community and meet people who can get to work. Also, I feel that we have a very good presence, and the members of the minority women and small business community know me. They know our campus staffs. They know they can call us. They have questions that they hear about projects, if they want to know what projects are coming forward, if they want to get involved in some of our programs. In addition to here, we're also the title sponsor of the Governor's Marketplace, which Cheryl spoke about at length. We're the only state entity that sponsors it, and we found it to be a very successful outlet for us to bring all of our campuses here to the Valley and sort of get some outreach even for people who aren't located here. We also have started a couple of other things coordinating with Cheryl's office, and she's been a huge help to us as far as focusing statewide and not just in Portland and the Valley, getting out to our smaller campuses, reaching out to those communities. She spoke about this in detail, so I'll just briefly mention that this is important to our rural communities as far as getting word out there about the certification process, about getting on the state list, and what that can do while we don't have goals, how that can help us get them identified and get them working on our campuses. We also have a lot of self-identified businesses that our campus staffs are providing that data to Cheryl in order for follow-up and trying to get them, especially in the rural communities, more on the certification list. Last year, our campuses and myself spent a lot of time working on a new policy that we could develop and adopt at the system level that allows our campuses the ability to focus our MWESB participation initiatives, but also to be very reflective of their unique communities, because that's something our board is also interested in, is keeping the dollars at our specific campuses, especially rural areas, to acknowledge that people and our campuses, say in LeGrand, are very different from our campuses in Portland and Eugene. So we spent a lot of time thinking of what we could do to, keep both those goals in mind and set a groundwork for us to keep constantly improving and making sure that we have a follow-up process at the board to look at what campuses' efforts are and their data on a year-to-year basis. And Chair Shields, you keep mentioning apples to apples, and that was exactly the words that our board said to us. And we kept having these same conversations about getting our participation up, and really we needed to see data so we could say, okay, in 2010 you're here, in 2011 you're here. That's an improvement, and that's where the board wants to go. So this policy, the major portions of it are outlined here. But as I discussed, each campus will have an outreach plan that will be reviewed annually by the board. The campuses will have an opportunity at that time to talk amongst themselves, share things that worked, things that aren't working, what companies have been successful, whether they're willing to travel, whether there's opportunities for working those synergies. Also, we have instituted some outreach initiatives where anything done through our retainer program, which I'll discuss in more detail following later in this presentation and the agenda, is that we'll get two bids from historically underrepresented businesses for anything where there is a bidding process. And we'll also, for anything that's an informally bid, we'll also get two bids from historically underrepresented businesses. So I think that that's been very helpful in showing the community that we're serious about, reaching out and getting what their ideas of what business they have the capacity to do, what they're interested to do, what they are able to participate in our campus, and getting their bids into the process. Also, what we found to be very useful and has really made already a big difference on our campuses is the CMGC aspect, where at least 10% of any CMGC project must include 10% at the minimum, and it could be more depending on the campus decisions, but at least 10% have to be awarded to a management plan, and that includes what are historical uses of the contractor on minority firms, women firms, emerging small business, whether they've been successful in meeting any aspirational targets in the past. We don't set aspirational targets, but we're interested in seeing what their success patterns on previous projects might be. It also includes workforce initiatives, whether they're getting any minority and women workforce numbers, and how they've been meeting those, and how they plan to approach this particular project, whether they have subs identified, that sort of thing. That's been very successful. And speaking to the data, we have set out very detailed guidelines for making sure we have data from all the construction projects, including subcontractors, which is a new thing we've just started as of 2011, where the subcontracting data will be required from all capital construction projects. So we're going to capture whether or not there's a minority company that may be working on our campuses as a third-tier sub, and not just the general contracting numbers, which weren't really reflective of the number of minority women and emerging small businesses that were working on our campuses. So that this policy was effective in November of last year. We have some of the data in that the campuses voluntarily reported for fiscal year 11, which we'll have, to discuss later on in this program. But next year, we will have all of this data. They have already been working on gathering it, and we're really excited to see sort of where our numbers are and where they compare to where we have been and areas where we can get better. So the next thing that we do that we think is very valuable for both the MWESB community and our campuses is the retainer contract program. It's a uniform contract. There are two separate contracts, one for construction, which is the data that you see here, and one for for professional consultants, which we'll discuss later on in the agenda. I didn't want to present it twice. But what we do is we open up a uniform contract. It's through an RFP process, but what we require for them to submit is to have all current licenses they need. So if it's a construction retainer, they have to have a CCB license, and that's sort of like the general line to how we determine whether you're eligible for the construction retainer program. You also need to have been in business for 5 years, or someone at your company doing the business that you are marketing yourself with doing. You have to be able to get insurance, but you're not required to carry insurance for the period of the contract. It's only once you're actually awarded work that we ask you to have the insurance certificates, because we don't want to put an undue burden for people to be paying for insurance if they're not doing work. So that's something that is important to the small firms. Starting this year, we're going to accept proposals on a rolling basis. So it's a 2-year term. If you get it in by a certain date, you'll be eligible for the entire 2 years. If you come in later, you might have a shorter term contract. But because we've upgraded our electronic systems, we're able to keep it open all the time, which is something new and something we heard back from the MWESB community about being very important. So here's some of our data for the last retainer program contract, which is up June 30th. So this is pretty much a full 2 year, or this is the last of the second year of the 2 year contract. And I also mentioned here the last year number that we presented at this hearing last year. And you can see that because of the prioritization and the focus that the board has requested, that we have really managed to up our numbers here. And using these $1 million and less contracts to get smaller businesses on our campuses, get in some work history with the project managers and with the campus capital construction staff. We've had about actually half as much spend in this program the last year than we had the previous year because of the budget situations, but we have managed to increase our participation by almost 100%. So, and then when it comes to the value of the contracts, by almost 300%. So we're really excited about this program and how this has been a vehicle for our campuses to make immediate improvements in their participation levels. And then here, our last two slides are the participation data that we collected for fiscal year 2011. And Chair Shields, I've heard you ask for a breakdown between MW and ESB. We can provide that to Jan. I can get that to you. For this graph, because this is the format through which we presented it last year, I wanted to just use the same one, and we'll provide a more detailed breakdown next year and also to Jan separately after this. Okay. But here you can see this is just capital construction. Some campuses already had systems in place to capture some of the subcontracting dollars. Some did not. So you can see there's indications for the campuses that had subcontracting and for those that didn't. And that's just capital construction. And then the goods and services is on this last page, and those are the breakdown of the campuses, goods and services, which is captured mostly through our banner systems, is how we're able to do the goods and services. It's not obviously as successful as some of our capital construction initiatives, but we're also working with our procurement staffs to really focus on things that we can do to get those numbers up.
So can I ask you a question about that?
Yeah.
So according to that chart, PSU only had $680,000 of contracted goods and services in 2011?
Yes, for MWESB.
Oh, that's the total amount for them. Okay, mm-hmm. That makes
it's just a little
different
more from sense. The handout, by the way. I don't know if this was updated.
No, there's a page after that.
Okay.
I do want to note that on the previous testimony from 2011, PSU, my alma mater, did much better, particularly on the Lincoln Hall contract with Howard S. Wright, where they had 28%. Subcontractor MWESB participation. I presume there's no capital construction happening at PSU right now. Is that part of?
Chair Shields and committee members, I'm David Hobbs, the Assistant Director for Contracts and Compliance at PSU. We do have one large capital project on the radar. I think everyone is aware of our Collaborative Life Sciences building project down on the South Waterfront in collaboration with OHSU. It's going to be a $200 million contract between both institutions, and that is our active capital project. We have about $40 million of that currently contracted. We are moving very soon to our guaranteed maximum price on that contract. But we do have data representative of that project, which is showing right about 16% participation at this point. that is our large capital project.
Okay, so those numbers aren't included?
They are not included here by any means. This is the 2010-2011. The Collaborative Life Sciences project began in May of 2011, so we've just are 1 year into that project.
Okay. And who's the prime on that?
J.E. Dunn.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? All right, please continue.
I'm finished.
Okay.
And if I would just add a couple of notes, if I could. One of the things that Hillary mentioned here is we did not previously have an ability in our contracts to collect subcontractor data. That's one of the reasons that PSU in particular, which I can speak to, is low. That is certainly not really representative of our numbers. We just simply did not have that mechanism. We do this year. You're going to see a great improvement in those numbers as we go forward on this, and we expect in January of 2013, you will see much better numbers coming from us. Secondarily, I think it's important to note with the change in status under SB 242 of the Oregon University System, one of the large challenges that we have had with the minority women-owned emerging small businesses is their ability to meet our insurance requirements that were dictated by the state tort cap limits. We are now subject to some different state tort cap limits as a result of Senate Bill 242. It should make it much easier for us to do more business with minority women-owned and emerging small businesses who have been very challenged in many cases in achieving those higher dollar values for insurance. And I think you will again see a greater increase in number and participation as a result of the changes in those rules.
All right.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Good. And we'll see you just a minute on the indefinite quantity contracts topic.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. All right, moving right along, could we please bring up Mark Matthews and Gail Castillo? And Brandon Flint. Welcome to the committee.
Welcome.
This is Gail's.
Feel free to proceed in any order you would like.
Okay. Senator Shields, committee members, my name is Mark Matthews, the president of the National Association of Minority Contractors of Oregon.
Senator Shields and committee members, my name is Brandon Flint. I'm a board member with NAMAC Oregon.
Good morning, Gail Castillo, the president of the Hispanic Metropolitan Chamber.
Thank you. We'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you this morning about the issues our members, about the issues that our members encountered in our efforts to work with the state of Oregon. And we believe that providing our members,
Take your time. You're doing fine.
He doesn't really bite.
Does
we keep him in check.
I feel like I'm on the hunt. So the state of Oregon, we're trying to make it an even playing field for all minorities in the public arena. I'm going to try to be brief and welcome the opportunity to have questions afterwards.
Excuse me. Some of the issues that we found through our board, one of the issues that we'd like to discuss today is the ODOT disparity study reports. The ODOT completed its update and disparity study last fall. The results of that study showed that the African American, the subcontinent, Asians continue to have significant disparities in contracting with ODOT. Based on that study, ODOT has proposed a race-conscious goal of 5% for those two groups. NAMAC Oregon had issues with the study, and we provided written comments. We questioned the methodology because we believe that the availability of the firms ready, willing, and able to work on ODOT projects is significantly higher than the study shows. Additionally, we believe that the study does not in any way address the absence of firms based on the historical discrimination in the construction industry. Societal discrimination has prevented the creation of more minority-owned firms To that end, we have urged ODOT to have higher goals and to take special measures to address the disparity that exists for African Americans. The group that has been seeing significant disparities of all the studies that have been done since 1995. One of the areas of the concerns that we raised with our comments on the disparity study, as well as in other discussions with ODOT, have been compliance concerns. Two areas primarily over the past few months of the concerns is DBE substitutions and terminations and the DBE trucking. First, with respect to the DBE trucking, ODOT study showed that about 75% of the dollars paid to African-American DBE firms were for trucking and flagging. On the trucking component, we have raised with ODOT concerns that the trucking arrangements on their projects are often contrived to overstate DBE utilization. Essentially, there is an abuse of the rule that allows for a non-DBE subcontracted or leased truck to actually count as a DBE in certain circumstances. DBE terminations and substitutions is another issue we'd like to discuss. We have also raised concerns about DBE subcontractors being terminated without good cause shown. This is a concern because on contracts that have DBE goals, if a contract is awarded because a prime has indicated that they have achieved the DBE goal, this permits them to turn around and terminate the DBE once a contract is underway, which happens in situations that lets prime contractors decide to perform the work themselves. We sent a public records request to ODOT in December requesting this information and did not receive anything from them until early this month. 5 months later, and they charged us almost $1,000 to provide us on a one-page listing of DBE firms that have been terminated or substituted in the past 3 years. This issue here is that ODOT is the DBE termination or substitution require approval by ODOT. Did that come out right? That the issue with that is that the DBE termination or substitution is typically required, is required to be approved by ODOT before that happens. There should be a central depository of this information, and it should have not taken 5 months to retrieve that information. The Office of Civil Rights should have been tracking this issue and involved in decision-making since it is a DBE compliance issue. Another issue that we have been looking at is a compliance gap that exists between certification of firms by OMWESB and the work some certified firms perform on projects, both state and local. The issue is that firms are certified based on their proven ability to control a particular type of work, electrical, for example. However, there is sometimes a disconnect between that certification and that firm's ability to perform a commercially useful function, which is a statutory requirement. For example, many of our members complain of some certified firms being aided on a project by a non-certified firm to such an extent that they appear to be no more than a front or a pass-through company for other firms who either actually perform the work with their own employees or provide all the materials and resources for those firms to do any work. The contracting agencies are not doing compliance to ensure certified firms are in fact performing commercially useful functions, and OMWESB is not doing any sort of field checks for that purpose either. Thus, we have a serious compliance gap. A couple of things on the general contracting side we'd like to discuss was the retainage issue. In addition to the compliance issues, we have also been engaged with ODOT, AGC, and other stakeholders on public contracting laws generally. For example, for the past several months, there have been a series of meetings with AGC and ODOT on ODOT's proposal to eliminate retainage from its projects and to require prime contractors to not hold retainage from their subcontractors. The issue here is that in Oregon and nationally, there's a problem with subcontractors not being paid and having to wait several months, even years, before receiving retainage payments. In these meetings, ODOT has acknowledged that closeout on their projects often take as much as 2 years. For a small minority contractor to wait 2 years to receive 5% of the value of a contract is essentially making them wait 2 years to see any profit from the work. ODOT eliminating retainage as federal law allows them to do is something we support and look forward to having become effective. Another issue that we have great interest in is protecting the CMGC contracting process. We've been sending a representative to the work group put together by Senator Beyer. We are hopeful that the CMG process not only survives but is expanded. It has been our experience that these processes provide not only best value for the agencies but also more opportunities for minority contractors and our members.
Again, we'd like to thank you. Thank the committee, and at this time, we'll be happy to answer any questions or provide additional information.
I do have a question. Could you talk a little bit about any specific examples around retainage that your members have had? Or would you, could you get, if none come up to the top of your head?
We can get that information for her. I don't think that we're.
Let me do this. We have been, on the retainage issue, we have been working with the committee, but we strongly feel that there should be no retainage withheld from small minority contractors at this time, but we're still working through those issues with ODOT and AGC.
Okay. If you could get us specific examples of any of your members who have really run into cash flow problems because of retainage, I think we'd be interested in seeing that as well. And you can just get that to the professional staff.
Okay. Because we do have, including myself, we do have some, had some issues in the past with retainage being released in a reasonable amount of time.
Can you just tell us your experience and challenge there?
Well, you know, the experience we've had is we'll complete a job, and we do not, as small business or as any business, do not get paid until the work is completely bought off by ODOT. So if we are doing a job that's we're working early in the process of the work, and our work might be the first part of the first couple months, let's say, and then the job goes for 2 years or 3 years, well, then we don't get to receive any retention. We have to wait till the job is completely done. And so we're trying to work through that to see what we can do to maybe eliminate that altogether. We're working with, like I said again, ODOT and AGC, but we like, as minorities, to not have the retention help, because that's our source of, we're banking on that to keep the revenue going and keep the company operating.
And so you're saying that minorities and women-owned businesses should get special consideration?
Well, no, I'm not saying, I'm not just saying women and minority, I'm saying all the way across the board, holding retention that long for anybody is really devastating, but especially for minorities who do a small portion of the work anyway, and to have 5% held for 2 years is quite some, quite a long time to, you know, to get paid for 2 years. You really need that money to keep your capital working and to keep business in your doors open.
Good. Thank you very much. Gail, please proceed.
Good morning. I sent my information. I don't know if it's loaded. Is it loaded in the this here?
No, we had, excuse me, we had your handouts. The committee has the handouts.
Okay.
I'm sorry,
that's
it's
fine.
Not loaded on the
laptop. Okay, that's fine. No problem. I didn't know if I was supposed to do this. I'm Gail Castillo with the Hispanic Chamber again. I didn't prepare a comment such as that. I just wanted to point out the growth of the minority population in Oregon. So the first chart that you have talks about the growth, and you can see the general community, the African American, etc. And I'll just point out that for the Latino community, our community has grown by 64% since the last measurement. And we represent 12% of Oregon's population, when, and therefore we're the largest ethnic minority in the state. And I'll just say later on in my comments that that's not reflected anywhere in the contracting, it's not reflected anywhere in the funding, anything. The Hispanic Chamber provides technical assistance to small businesses. We have other programs as well. And we've served over 1,800 businesses, Latino and other businesses, which includes African American, Asians, and white females, and others. We've helped them access over $7 million in financial transactions, which includes loans, lines of credit, purchasing of equipment, etc. And I'll just make a note that we've assisted them in the certification process, which is important for the state in order for them to be recognized as a potential vendor for some of these programs. On the next chart, I'll just point out that of the over almost 350,000 firms, there are over 32,000 minority-owned firms. And you can see by this chart, over 35% of the minority-owned firms are Latino in Oregon. And the last chart talks about Oregon's construction firms. Of the 40,000 construction firms, there are over 2,700 minority firms. And of those minority firms, 51% of Oregon minority construction firms are Latino. Again, that's not reflected in any of the contracting data that you'll be reviewing as the agencies get back to you with their numbers. I also want to point out that we too, the Hispanic Chamber, did write a letter to ODOT regarding their recent review of their DBE program. Interesting enough, despite these numbers, Latinos are not even identified as a goal for ODOT to consider contracting. Again, we've challenged over the years the data that they've used. It's old data. When you tell me that you're urging them, this other state agencies, to do a disparity study, frankly, it scares me, because the firms that have come in have used old data. It's not reflective of our current population. Some of the vendors, the contractors that they say, they're saying Latinos, there's no disparity. Well, a lot of the contractors, the big contractors that got a lot of those large contracts from ODOT, et cetera, are either dead or they're retired, and they're no longer existing. So that data was old data. It doesn't reflect our current population. So now to be excluded from the ODOT DB goals is a travesty, and it diminishes our ability to have opportunities in the state of Oregon. And what's happening is they're going across the river to Washington, just so you know, because Oregon has not been a welcoming state for Latino businesses in any way. I will also say that despite all this, we do have working relationships both with Cheryl and her office and the other state agencies. We try to put our best foot forward to work with the agencies, but I will just say it's been difficult because of all the rules, the regulations, the lack of payment, the slow payment. There's so many rules and there's so many regulations that it's a disincentive for, frankly, anyone, I don't care what color you are, to do business with the state agencies. But it's even more cumbersome if you're a small, struggling minority business. The large firms, as you know, have huge staffs. They have dedicated staff that do the contracting, that do the oversight, that do the administration, that track all that. Most of the minority firms in Oregon, whatever color they are, don't have that huge capacity. So it is a burden on them to try and conduct business in Oregon. I will say again that we look forward to working with any of the agencies to increase opportunities for not only Latinos but other groups, and we will have a trade show on June 26th at the Oregon Convention Center. There have been some agencies, I'll just say, that have signed up to participate, but not as many as we'd like to see. They should be there. They should be doing outreach to our community, and sometimes that happens and sometimes it doesn't. So I'm being brutally honest because I only got a few minutes. Thank you for your time and thank you for the invitation here. I look forward to working with all of you. And if there's any questions that you have, I'd be happy to answer them.
I think one thing, I'll get right to you. One thing that I would encourage you and the other minority chambers to do as well is to work on a legislative agenda to come forward, or so that we can continually improve every session going forward. And I know that's a challenge, but these things aren't going to change by themselves. So we're going to need everybody at the table to roll up their sleeves and help in that. Senator Dingfelder?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to add, thank you all for being here today, obviously, to give us a reality check on some of the information we've been hearing. But I think what would be helpful, and I completely understand what I'm hearing is, and I know, because like as I mentioned, having gone and filled out the paperwork myself and having to meet some of those requirements myself as a former WBE, I understand the
That the procedures that the state has in place, what I'm hearing, is acts as a disincentive. It's just easier, you know, just work with private industry. You don't have to go through all this. However, we are a big source of potential contracts, obviously, the government is, whether it's at the local, state, or federal level. I'm not even going to begin to talk about the federal level because that's a whole nother level of
yes.
bureaucracy. But what would be helpful, I think, to hear from you is what can we do. You know, writing laws is important, but it's not obviously going to change the corporate culture of how we do work here. So recommendations that you have about how the state can help facilitate, I understand, you know, we've had a change in administration, and I think the new administration is a breath of fresh air as far as the emphasis being put on this issue. But the reality is that our resources are limited as well. Certainly, I think it would be wonderful if we could employ liaisons to work directly with small and WB and, you know, minority businesses to help, because as one person, if you're a single business owner, it's daunting, it's overwhelming, and you know, if you it's very difficult, and you don't have the money to hire somebody to do that. So obviously that would be the best if we could have people that could be there as a resource, and there are some firms I know that are filling that gap. But if you have recommendations or other thoughts, you know, maybe a couple of quick points now, but if you could follow up with some recommendations, particularly on that point, Gail, it'd be really helpful.
May I respond to that? Senator, and Senator Shields is aware of this, the state of Oregon did have a program that was funded through the Oregon Business Department, they keep changing that name,
that
assisted
yeah.
Minority and other and women-owned businesses to help them expand their business and do their marketing, but also included contracting.
Mm-hmm.
And that funding for the organizations, including ourselves, we were part of that, one of the groups that was funded, went away. So, you know, we're a nonprofit. We're kind of a non-traditional chamber. We're a nonprofit. And like the state, you know, our resources have shrunk. The opportunities for funding have diminished. But somewhere along the line, someone has to make it a priority to say, you know, yes, there are diminishing resources, but yes, these issues of including the minority and women businesses as part of our economic development plan is a priority, because other things become priority. Solar becomes priority, sustainability becomes priority, grass and owls become priority, but somehow minority women businesses are not priorities as it relates to funding. So yes, there was a program, and yes, there could be a program to assist women and minorities to access contracts if it's the will of the legislature to fund it. It's like everything else.
And it also needs to be in the governor's budget. So I would encourage
you. And it needs to be in the governor's budget.
To advocate. It's always easier to keep something in the governor's budget than to add
right.
something back to it. So I would encourage you to all of you to work on it. And the program that Gail's referring to is called the Targeted Services Providers Program. I can tell you that most people in the legislature probably don't even know it exists. So,
right.
And what happens down here is that those who or the squeaky wheels tend to get the grease. So I know that's a full-time job to be engaged in, but I would encourage you to engage in it to the greatest degree possible moving forward.
Thank you.
Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
One last thing. Going back to the disparity study issue, MGT, I think, was the contractor. Two huge volumes on for both the disparity study about 4 or 5 years ago and the most current one.
Mm-hmm.
Did one thing that I think could be helpful, and I'd be interested if you were given an opportunity to do this, was there a comment period for the drafts? Did anybody run the drafts by you?
Well, I think there was a comment period, but the time we got a hold of it and was able to respond back, it was already a done deal, I believe.
That train was on that track.
Yeah, it was.
So there was a comment period for the draft?
Yeah, I think.
Okay. So maybe we can keep that in mind for future studies, because if there is, I mean, they list all the companies that are in there as part of the appendix, and if there's inaccurate information, they certainly need to know that before they finalize it.
In regards to the disparity study, I haven't seen, I mean, reading it, this one currently and the one back in 95 is not much of a change, although ODOT adopted a 5%, and I think back then they had a higher percentage, so the percentages actually went down.
Okay. Well, from your perspective, what you're saying is that the number of firms is no longer accurate, and they do list in the appendix who all those firms are, and so if their documents are inaccurate, we need to make sure that going forward that maybe the comment period needs to be expanded so that the community has a better chance to weigh in before we finalize it, because I mean, those recommendations are critical. They provide the basis for hard goals in the future, and I certainly appreciate what you're saying. So thank you very much for your testimony.
Thanks.
Okay. I hear Representative Clem is still asleep at home, so he's... I'm just kidding. I'm sure he's been up since 5 working hard. He's not here yet, though, so we're going to proceed with the discussion about price agreements and A&E services. Could we please bring back Hillary Bounds and David Hobbs? And colleagues, if I could just tee this up, there was Senate Bill 667 in previous sessions, and I think it had a new number in the last session that identified the degree to which small businesses have a chance at what they call indefinite quantity contracts or price agreements, basically on-call services for A&E drafting and engineering services. And so we brought up, we couldn't reach agreement in the last legislative session on a bill to get all the way through the process, and so we're going to continue to hammer on this as we go into the next legislative session. We've had the bulk of state agencies that engage in these come and present before. One agency that was said the small minority contractors had some concerns about was with OUS, and so we wanted to be sure to bring them forward to have them present how they do indefinite quantity contracts or price agreements and any path for improving that in the future. So welcome back to the committee.
Hi, Chair Shields and committee members. Again, I'm Hillary Bounds. I'm the OUS Director of Contracting and Purchasing. My office administers the retainer program contracts for both construction and professional services. So I'm going to speak briefly about the contracts, their functional way that we maintain them and solicit companies for them, and then David will speak briefly about how the campuses use them and the benefits and usefulness for the operations of the campuses. So we spoke briefly about the construction side. Now to speak specifically to the professional consultants, we had submitted some data in February previous to the prior hearings, but we have a two-year cycle for our professional consultants contract. The current one, I started in March of this year, so it was open previously, and we've provided data for the 3 years. Specifically to talk about MWESB data and the small businesses. It's not up on the slides, unfortunately. It was just a handout that we mailed in. We have 314 total firms on the professional consultants retainer contract, 112 of those for it constantly fluctuates based on the licenses that are available, and our program keeps that up to date. But in the previous 2 years, it was 112 of those received supplements, which are the work orders off of that. So it's about 30% get work once you're on the retainer program. And when we talk about logistics of how to get on the retainer program, it's a very low threshold for entrance. So in our last cycle, I indicated it here, but it's 97.5% of anyone who submitted an application got on the retainer program. So really, they have to have the proper licenses to do the work that they indicate that they are wanting to market to the campuses, and they have to have been in business for a certain number of years. That's pretty much all that it requires. We have estimated it takes pretty much less than an hour to get on the program, and that we found that it's beneficial to have as many people on the program, and while that means some people won't get work, sort of as we think about these things logistically, we feel that at least having them on the program and putting a low threshold to get on is better than a higher threshold and guaranteeing that a certain or higher percentage will get work. So that's sort of how that program developed, and it was before that I became here, but we've been running it for, I think, about 10 years. And our usage data for the MWESB for the last year is presented also in this handout. We weren't able to track the MWESB on our previous databases because they were not technologically capable of doing that. So we only have the MWESB usage starting February 1st of 2011. But about 23%, or it is actually 23%, of the firms that received work orders for the professional consultants were MWESB, and percentage of the MWESB firms that were on the database that then received work orders was about 23% of the MWESB firms. In total, the amount of money that went to MWESB firms was $833,000 for 8% when you 8% of the total spend. When it comes to our campuses and the operations, I'm going to let David speak to that and how they use these databases, which are now maintained electronically, and you can sort for specifically minority or specifically women or specifically emerging small business. While we don't award contracts on those bases, you can see which firms are there and which are available to do the work.
So good morning again, Senator Chair Shields and members of the committee. I'm David Hobbs, the Assistant Director for Contracts and Compliance at Portland State. I should have mentioned earlier, Senator Shields, it's great to have a Viking on in the legislature and supporting of us. We're grateful for that, and great to see alumni here in the legislature. In terms of our campus operations and the use of the retainer program, this is really focused on low dollar value contracts. I think has been indicated here, it's for contracts that are less than $1 million in value. Typically, for most of the campuses and most of the work that we do on these, the work is generally less than $100,000. We do have some that are larger, but what this program really helps us with is it gives us immediate access to the qualifications and data for firms. As Hillary mentioned, we maintain an online database for the retainer program. In there is the entire proposal that is submitted by these firms. It's got their history, their experience, their financial capacity, their insurance information, past projects, qualifications of staff, all readily available to us. That typically is not out there in the general community without going to the firms, figuring out which firm it is, and trying to get information coming from them. This is a very easy way for us to do business with firms and, again, have that information readily available. As Hillary mentioned, the program is very easy to get on. I'm out there in the community as well as many of the events that Hillary is at. We're conducting our own outreach events as well, and this is the standard message that's delivered by us and all the other campuses is the retainer program is a great way for us to do business. We have immediate knowledge of your firm and how to do business with you. It also is a much quicker process for us to get firms under contract. Rather than going through a month to 2 month process of a full RFP that is formal and open to everybody that is licensed to do business in that area across the state, we typically are getting that down to 2 to 3 weeks, even when we are doing a formal RFP process for those members that are on the retainer program. That expedites our ability to get projects completed timely. We believe that we have good price data. We have good hourly rates that are included in the retainer program. And again, it just provides a much easier way for us to contract with these firms and have direct knowledge of it. These numbers always continue to amaze me that we have such actually low participation overall in the retainer program. We have 300 firms, as Hillary mentioned. I expect this year we're going to see that going up, especially with the changes that we're now implementing to create some rolling enrollment processes. That's one of the big things we hear from a lot of the vendors at these community events is, oh, I just missed the deadline to get on the retainer program. That's very frustrating because then they wait 2 years until they try to sign up again. This new process that we've implemented is going to be, again, make it much easier for firms to get on the retainer program and, again, give all of the campuses much more readily access to their qualifications and their experience directly. Thank you.
And one thing to add was when we look at it from the perspective that David, and when you're talking about the information that's available, it also is helpful for the small business to only have to provide that information once to one source and not to constantly be asked by each of the 7 campuses to provide the same information over and over again. Because when we're speaking to small businesses, you know, there's sometimes their ability to respond to proposals quickly as they're posted. And when you're talking about 7 universities, this is a little bit of a more efficient process for them to market to a single source.
So one thing I noticed in your testimony, you suggested it only takes about an hour to fill out the paperwork to get on this list.
Mm-hmm.
That's your argument. And then tell me about the bonding requirements that are involved.
There are no bonding requirements up front to get on the retainer program, to get registered on individual projects, and especially not on the consultant side. On the consultant side, there is no bonding requirements at all. I'm thinking of our construction-related services. So there's absolutely no bonding requirements. There's no requirements to provide insurance up front. As Hillary mentioned, we basically are asking for a statement that, yes, you can achieve these levels of insurance. As I mentioned in my testimony earlier, that was really tied into the tort cat limits previously, so it was increasing each year over from I believe 2010 to 2015. We basically said, are you able to maintain this insurance or get this insurance if given a supplement? And that's the only requirement that's there. When we enter into an individual supplement for a project, the individual campuses will assess the risk on a project and assign an insurance value and ask for an insurance certificate at that point in time.
Okay. And your testimony is that about 30% of all that are registered get work in about a 2-year period, and that about 30% of those who got work are MWESBs?
Yeah, I think it was 23%.
23%. Okay. So I don't see any of the proponents of what was Senate Bill 667 in the room, but do you have any sense of what their frustration might have been based on with OUS? They mentioned OUS specifically as being challenging to work with in this realm.
I mean, I would say through the hours that I do, and the most common complaint is we've signed this contract and we're not getting work. I mean, when you're saying that 30% get it, obviously that means 70% are not. And so that is something that, you know, is unfortunate, and that our board is, you know, prioritized that we get more and more contractors on campus. So as that is the priority of the board, that we would see that trickling down to the campuses. You know, however, there are certain services that just aren't in demand, and David can speak to this on a more campus level, but just from what I've heard, you know, say there's someone who provides a certain, like a CAD service, you know, Portland State, I think, has the in-house CAD services, so they don't necessarily ever contract out for CAD. So there are certain service group silos on the contract, because you do indicate whether you're an engineer, architect, you know, IT, you don't get on to do every service. You get on to do the service that your company specifically provides. So you'll probably find, if we dug down, and we could speak to you about more specifics if you had targeted questions like that, we can dig through some of the data, especially for the last year when it was the new database, as far as how many of a specific skills are getting the work. And I think you'll probably find that is a higher number when you're talking about skills that are used by every campus. But that's probably the primary complaint that I hear when I do the outreach.
Okay. And when you call them retainer contracts, are these indefinite quantity contracts for A&E services, or is the universe much broader than that?
I'm sorry. They're a uniform contract, and they stipulate an hourly rate for each of the levels of their firms. I guess if you have an associate or a partner, different hourly rates for the different staff members they have. Is that...
I'm saying this list that you provided, is this only for A&E services?
Yes, that's just the A&E. So we didn't include the construction data because we thought this was to just be A&E. We can also provide that same data for the construction side. But those lists are just lists of every A&E firm that we have on the list and whether or not they have received a supplement or work order, as they're sometimes referred to, during the course of the contract, and whether they're also MWESB certified.
That's great. So you have the data on which of the ones who received contracts are MW and ESBs?
Mm-hmm. So that if you look up their name on those spreadsheets, it will indicate whether they're MWESB. I think that's the second column, and then the third column should be whether or not maybe they didn't print out correctly.
We just have the name of the firm and whether they received a work order.
Oh, okay. The Excel package we meant to send had whether they were MWESB was one of the columns, too.
Okay.
But I'm not sure. It may have just been the column didn't print, or we can resend it.
And we have access to the spreadsheet.
Oh, okay, yeah, because it was in the spreadsheet. One of the columns was whether they are MWESB certified.
Right. And, Jen, could you get it to the committee members, but also send it to the proponents if they wanted to comment on that? Perhaps what their concern is that, you know, since you're going out and you're pursuing these with so many different firms, that perhaps you might want to consolidate it, because the small firms argued that there's a cost for readiness that is not taken into account. And I'm looking at, you know, one of the proponents, I think, isn't even on the list anymore, probably because they decided that they were not going to, they didn't get any work in the past, they're not going to get any work in the future. So you might want to just consider whether or not that's really being as supportive as it could be of the minority women in emerging small businesses.
We're just worried that if we put up more restrictive guidelines, that it would then weed out the smaller firms, because they will probably be the, if we raise the requirements, those are probably going to be the ones that would fall beneath those requirements. We then couldn't restrict entry based on, you know, a MW status, maybe ESB in certain circumstances.
Okay.
So that might be something we can talk about.
And so tell me a little bit more about the process of who gets selected once they get put on the list. Is it once a real work order comes down, I assume it's not competitive and that you just negotiate with someone that you select?
Senator Shields and committee members, at Portland State, I think in general at all the campuses we do it pretty much the same. There are three different levels of thresholds for how we work within the retainer program. Under $100,000, we for A&E proposals in particular, we do have the ability to direct award those contracts, and that is basically a selection is made off of the retainer list of firms that are available, again, based on qualifications, based on the information that they've submitted. There's areas of expertise, whether it be in engineering or in architecture. Depending on the type of project, we will really look at what firm best meets the needs for that individual project. For larger projects, in the range of $100,000 to $250,000, it's an informal RFP process that is run. That requires a minimum solicitation of three proposals from members of the retainer program. That, again, does get posted on the OUS website. That ties into, I believe, Cheryl Meyer's office as well. That is more of a, it is truly a proposal that we get that identifies the services, the rates, the costs, et cetera, associated with the individual work, but it is a more restricted pool. For the range of $250,000 to $1 million, that is a formal RFP process that is open to everyone on the retainer program, that we do not do, anyone is free to submit on that, and we then go through an evaluation process as we would with any solicitation to evaluate, again, rates, background and experience, and fit for the individual project. And that's the same as we would do on any open procurement that was a non-retainer program recruitment as well.
And we have some campuses, and I know especially our regional campuses, that publicly post every single supplement that they do on here, regardless of, you know, price. That's just how they do so few that it makes sense for them to just post them always and see who's out there and who's able to do the work. So each campus makes certain decisions on the project level. But I do know that they do vary among the seven campuses.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Great. Questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Should we then bring up Representative Clem. Is there anyone else?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Diane.
All right. Representative Clem is in the room. I took a shot at you earlier. I said you were still in bed.
Well, I heard. I along with my alarm buzzer.
Could we please bring up Representative Clem, Diane Lancaster, and Clyde Psyche? Rep. Clem, and just to tee this up for those who may be listening, Representative Clem found an innovative way to pass an Oregon, by Oregon bill in the last Legislative House, Bill 3000. We were very pleased to have that come through our committee, and we want to just get a check-in on how things were going. So, Representative Clem, why don't you lead it off?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and member of the committee. For the record, I'm Brian Clem, State Representative from District 21 here in Salem. And what I'm going to do is talk a little bit also about results of the precursor to 3000, which was 2763, which dealt with food, because that'll give us a little bit of a roadmap of what's likely to happen with 3000. What we found, as you know, in the past when we tried doing some of these things through the legislative process, LFO would come back and say, unless you make it optional, we're going to put a fiscal on there that's sort of the maximum potential price that you're putting into the bill. So if the state does $5 billion in procurement a year and you put shall buy Oregon products, we're going to have, at anything up to a 10% preference, we're going to have to times $5 billion times 10%, and that's going to be your fiscal. And that made it a challenge, obviously, to get through Ways and Means. So this last time we said May, and then we wanted to work with a friendly governor who was interested in this issue to implement it. It also helps avoid some of the situations with reciprocity that we talked a little bit about, where you can be a little bit more case by case and not apply the preference in contracts in cases where we do have a sector that's doing a lot of business with other state governments and they don't really want an Oregon preference because they're afraid it would penalize them in their other places. So this allows a little more selectivity. So one thing to know was the implementation date effectively ended up being January 1st because of the rulemaking process. So we've got a shorter window than probably most of us would want of experience with the implementation because it took 6 months to get that part done. Since that time, the governor's established essentially a working group that they bring in different parts of his office and different folks in procurement to talk about 3000 and get the word out about it. Because what we found is there were a lot of bidders in the food arena who they'd given up doing business with the state of Oregon. Like, they'd tried it a lot of times over the last 20-25 years, and they're like, you know what, we're not doing that anymore. So getting the word out to them that there's actually, please come and try again, it's going to be different this time, you know, you can trust us, we're from the government. That's not always that easy to do. So part of our initiative is trying to get the word out to vendors. And one way to do that is through the regional solutions folks who are out in the different parts of Oregon doing, you know, formerly the economic revitalization team. We've got folks who are out there working with local governments and businesses all around the state. So one of our early, they call it the war room, but we have a war room on different topics on implementation, and House Bill 3000 has its own war room on implementation. So we brought in all the regional solutions coordinators, talked to them about it, explained how the law works so they could go out and sort of spread their networks. The other thing that we found was having a cheerleader in procurement really helps a lot, like someone who's really motivated to do it. And so, although he's not here today, I want to talk a little bit about Dave Reynolds at DAS, who worked on the food procurement stuff and is working on 3000 and comes to the war room, because some of the specific victories that we've already had, I think, are a large part attributable to having a cheerleader who's really motivated to try and make this happen. So, for example, the state hospital alone has increased its purchasing by $10,000 a month to local business, local farmers in direct food sales after the advent of 2763. There's about a $100,000 a month for one business. Charlie's Grocers is getting about $100,000 a month in new state contracts. That was a lifesaver for them. Childers Meats in Eugene got a 26,000-pound order for roast beef, which was a very large order for them and sort of pushed them to capacity right off the bat. And so, okay, how many more of these, you know, can we get before we need to ramp up? Or how many more of these are there going to be? And it's had an effect on other entities that do business in Oregon that realize that they need to change their purchasing behavior. So, for example, Food Services of America, which has offices here, but they're not headquartered here, they've realized that to be able to compete with what the preferences of the state are, they're going to have to buy more local foods as well. And so it's changed behavior for both Sodexo and FSA to start procuring a lot more so they can argue to, like, the school district, for example, where Sodexo is, no, you don't need to kick us out and go with somebody who's Oregon-based because we're already buying all this stuff from Oregon. So it's creating a competition to who can buy the most Oregon, and which is positive. I mean, even if, you know, those of us who like the Oregon-based part of the bill still would take, if 90% of the purchasing goes to Oregon, that's still a large improvement from where we were. The other thing that's really interesting is it created new opportunities that we didn't necessarily envision. We were thinking, in any given contract, you might have somebody who was 5 or 6 or 7% below the low bid, and this might get them a shot at being included. What we didn't necessarily envision was the ability to create entirely Oregon-owned contracts that sort of have their own standing now, where they're not necessarily competing on a contract-by-contract basis. What I mean by that, this is just an example, in the solar installation business, you've got all the component parts and installers and architecturing and engineering all in Oregon. You can buy it from a place that's manufactured in Oregon. You can install with Oregon installers. You can have all the engineering and layout done by Oregon people. Well, in the normal contracting process, you know, there wasn't necessarily assembled a package of Oregon only options. It was just Oregon vendors were competing in every category of those different segments of the installation and procurement, or the installation and wafers, and there were Oregon people in there. So what Dave helped put together, or somebody at DAS did, and Dave reported to me on it, they've completed an Oregon-only package that any government entity in Oregon who wants to do solar can buy into. So rather than scouring through their existing RFPs for where the Oregon companies are, there will be an Oregon-only thing that's already a master contract, already been let, the price already has come back in, and then people can just adopt it without even having to go to another RFP. And that, to me, was not something I even thought about, but that's what I mean by having a cheerleader who's interested in taking the law to its maximum creativity to try and find ways to buy more Oregon. Our next steps in 3000, because a lot of what I mentioned were their specific victories are food related, and that was really because 2763 has been in effect for a couple years. Our next step in 3000 is having the governor write a letter to both his agencies that he's responsible for and all procurement agencies, short of an executive order, but a letter and some press activities to try and get the information out to other agencies, you know, local cities, counties, who don't know about 3000, don't know they can even do this, to make them aware of it, and also to try and get some media attention around some of the success stories so other businesses will see that, you know, X company got involved in the Oregon Radio Project, and that's an Oregon company who, because of this law, are now be able to build towers. Or the guy wrote me about playground equipment, and he's always losing to this place from Canada by just a little bit, and he's hoping, you know, that he can get in on playground equipment. And there's office supply people who were down at the bill signing saying, you know, we always lose to Office Depot by a point or two, and yet all their money goes back to wherever their corporate headquarters is. So our goal is to get some success stories in the newspaper so other businesses will actually reach out. We've also sort of created a plan for being able to go around to some of the chambers of commerce and advertise it through their mechanism so they have a little bit more awareness, because that's a lot of the battle. Truett Brothers here in Salem, who is just laying off 100 more people, have told me that Oregon has been a terrible customer, so they gave up a long time ago, and they sell to Georgia, and they sell their school system, all of their produce that they do pears and green beans, and they were selling that all in Georgia, none in Oregon, until we started becoming a little bit better customers. We're not caring only about the absolute lowest dollar. So anyway, that's sort of where we're at. I'd say, you know, the figure I got back from Dave was, between the two bills, we've already seen about $10 million in state purchasing return from out of state to in state. And a lot of that had to do with a particular category. It's called well, it's essentially in the lawn and garden and supply arena, and there was a master contract that almost all state agencies were using that was a Washington one, because they had had sort of a pretty good one already assembled, and so you could just opt into that. Well, it ended up going to a lot of Washington vendors. So now we've since made an Oregon contract. This created a lot of new opportunities for Oregon distributors, for like John Deere. There'll be a locally owned distributor of John Deere, and they were all losing out all of the state sort of lawn, garden, equipment, maintenance type business to Washington, and that's returned, said about $10 million in revenue back to the state of Oregon. So that's obviously the hope. We want to keep expanding. Part of it is getting the word out, you know, to folks that it's available, and having agencies, I think, you're doing a little bit of this already, thank you, having agencies report on how it's going. I think that'll build in some accountability, where if you know in your next Ways and Means presentation you're going to need to talk about how much, you know, Buy Oregon work you did in your agency, it makes you more likely to do Buy Oregon work, frankly.
Thank you, Representative Clem. Much appreciated for not only your testimony today, but being able to thread the needle in a way that doesn't, we've always had the problem with the reciprocity question, and this was a very innovative way to get this done. Senator Rosenbaum, did you have a question?
No, I share your compliments, and I'm going to just thank the representative for his leadership. I think when this bill passed, there was some feeling that maybe it was what we sometimes refer to as a feel-good bill that wouldn't accomplish a whole lot, but obviously it has. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Senator, Madam Leader. my wife's boss. Well, I don't it is critical to have an executive branch motivated and interested. I mean, I found, obviously, after two tries at it before, it wasn't going to work the other way. And having a partner in the governor's office who is interested in local sourcing and pushes, and having an implementation team assigned from his office to push, that is that's really the key right now. If we can figure out another way to change our LFO and LRO scoring that would count the multiplier effects, you know, that would probably make the bill not as expensive to be putting shells in there. But for now, this is our formula. This is the way we do it, and this seems to be working pretty well for these local businesses. They're definitely happy. And there's a few others who I expect they were worried about losing. So they had the contract, like Mark Nelson Oil Products was one that contacted us. They have state card lock contracts.
Mark Nelson owns an oil
company. It's not different Mark Nelson. And they're here in Salem. They have state card lock for people to refuel their deal without having to go to bulk rate fueling, without having to go to a gas station. And they've had the contract. They're just worried about over time encroachment and losing it to somebody who comes in and can do it, you know, a half point lower or something like that. And so maintaining employment is almost as important as shifting procurement. A lot of these businesses said during this downturn, this is like the one thing that was going up and boosting was more state procurement opportunities. And otherwise, we would have been laying people off, and we're able to keep everybody. And I'm Quad Dairy, and Spring Valley Dairy sort of fit that category.
Great testimony, good story. Clyde, you want to go?
Yeah, it's probably Diane can set the stage, and I'll jump in.
I'll be happy. Well, you have a handout. I really appreciate Representative Clem's comments. One of the things that the procurement community has been very pleased with is that this is a different reference. Representative Clem has really covered nicely the issues around other types of preferences. It is not a residency preference, and of course that was a real barrier in the past. As you know, and he's Representative Clem has already covered this, and I'm sorry, Diane Lancaster for the record. The agency may pay up to 10% more for goods fabricated or processed entirely in Oregon, or services performed entirely in Oregon, and they can add, they can create more of a percentage with some justification. Does not encroach into construction work at this time. The work group that Representative Clem spoke of, we have also had a supplementary work group at the procurement manager level with several departments working on and have created now the sample solicitation, contract language, creating the networking with agencies around the preference, certainly responding to inquiries and sharing lessons learned. A lot of outreach, publicity, and work with the governor's office. The governor's office materials that Representative Clem spoke about are in final form and ready to be released. So we'll see that, again, that executive push
coming out here, I believe, by next week. And in fact, I'm going to go to the Oregon Procurement Officers Association meeting next week in Bend, and this will be a presentation that I'll be making to them as well. So we are jazzed in the procurement industry. One thing we have done in Orpen, and I mentioned this earlier this morning, we have created a buy or tag to offer easy identification for opportunities for Oregon products and services. The agency can just click and put that tag on, and that pretty well signals the procurement world, the buyers and sellers, that this is going to be a buy or preference item. You'll notice that I thought it was real interesting. This was just a sample. We've had, as Representative Clem pointed out, we really went operational January 1st, and so we took a count. We've had 19 solicitations with this tag in Orphan since January 1, and it was interesting that we had the mobile espresso cart for the state hospital. I thought was an interesting one, and then fabrication of aluminum floating restrooms. So there's been a variety of goods and services. Again, I think Representative Clem made a point that this has opened up some creativity in the procurement arena to look at other things and to think out of the box. Dave Reynolds fortunately works in our office, so he's been definitely on point and a passionate person with this.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Yes, certainly.
So there were 19 solicitations. Do you know the end result? How many of those 19?
Senator Shields, yes, 19 solicitations. I looked yesterday at the listing. Some of them are still in process. I did look at the listing of those that had closed. They were all for agricultural or food products, so that's good. I don't know the rest of the story yet on some of the new ideas coming through, so we'll be reporting, of course, back on that.
Yeah, could you get to the professional staff the list of the Oregon contractors who succeeded under the solicitation process by Oregon solicitation process?
Sure. Okay. As Representative Clem pointed out, there are a lot of good things coming out of this, and some of the points that we're making as we get out and talk with purchasing people and others are, again, many of the points that Representative Clem has made. The good news about this is it is more about excitement and passion than cost, and it is about that creative thinking and creating some buzz in the marketplace. Food and grocery contracts have been very successful. Department of Corrections has been, they've encountered great success. We had a very interesting follow-up story to what Representative Clem mentioned. One of the things that we found with Food Service of America and some of the large, big food services groups is that when we talked to them, they're willing to make, they want to make some money, and they're willing to do what they need to do to help us. And an interesting little story, the Food Service of America for Eastern Oregon, they decided they would allow their Boise and Spokane distribution centers, okay, so other states, distribution centers, but they would extend the Oregon pricing. And that's great because those agencies and foster homes and whatnot along the borders can take advantage of the state pricing. And, of course, FSA they're buying Oregon products to provide the state pricing. So we're trying to, again, kind of serve a variety of needs. The representative has already mentioned some of the successful businesses, Charlie's Produce, Childers Distributing, Umpqua Dairy, Spring Valley Dairy, et cetera. And finally, a little story about milk. And this one is dear to our hearts over at the office. We had, through this effort, we would have been able to establish a contract for milk. The current price for locally produced milk is 24 cents for the little cartons. And again, if you recall, I mentioned how many local governments are using our contract. The school districts particularly we've been trying to encourage. And we had a child nutrition program provider at the local level who recently contacted us and said, hey, I'm saving $200 a week on my milk order because of this savings. And so again, an anecdote, but an important one. About the cost savings through these efforts. And so that was just, we got a couple of good stories. Yes, and I'll provide the statistics on what we know so far. And of course, this will build as we come back into next session and whatnot. We'll have more statistics.
So, Diane, let me make sure I understand the significance of the example. You said, is the point that the Bioregion program forced or allowed this charter school to take a look anew at a contract that they might not have looked at for 3 or 4 years, and then they not only found that they could give it to a local company, but they found that they could actually save money there?
Yes, Senator Shields, that's exactly what we're saying. And again, this is somewhat, it's not always easy to measure in a straight line way, especially when you're sort of building this kind of program. But we're working on trying to figure out good measurements. But I think the creativity that this is unleashing is what's exciting to us in the procurement work. The fact that it is discretionary, I think, frankly, to us is an advantage, because we can get we can look at a variety of things. We're not channeled into something. And Dave is just one example of the type of procurement agent who is, he's caught the passion, and he's just looking at everything he's got in his portfolio of work to say, what could I do? And that's the kind of thing that we want to excite, because I think that's where those success stories like Milk can happen. And it comes from putting together some different things, like encouraging K-12 participation in the orphan and in the, you know, in the contracting work, and then thinking about things like Milk and the little cartons, so you have to kind of string those beads together to really tell the story. But I'm very excited about the potential for this. And if I could, I will say that Oregon's shining very bright out in the country. I was invited to go to a symposium by the American Bar Association back in Washington, D.C. about a month ago, and they were talking about local and state public contracting law. Well, I gave them some information about House Bill 3000, and they were very startled, because most states are still hammering on the in-state residency-based idea. And so this was a new idea, and I was very proud to be an Oregonian at that moment. So thank you.
Hopefully more than that moment, but
always.
Especially proud.
If anything I came across recently, no, always proud.
That's great. Diane, do you know, does Portland Public Schools, do they use ORPIN for this type of endeavor?
Portland Public Schools is an ORCAP member, and they use our contracts. I don't know exactly. I'm not sure about the use, like the Milk story. I'm not sure what the facts are about their usage. Okay. But that's an interesting, I'll be meeting and talking with many of those folks next week in Bend at the Oregon Public Purchasing Association. I'll be sure to ask, and we might follow up a little more with them to say, hey, what are you guys doing around
find out how much they're paying for Milk, would you?
Yeah. That was absolutely dramatic. Yeah. No question.
That's a great story. Good. Any other questions? Well, I think, we wrestled with what we can actually do to help small business, and in the grand scheme of massive macroeconomic fraud challenges that are bringing down our economy, trade policy that too often encourages our jobs to go overseas, state government can only do so much. But I think, making sure people get paid on time, that retention policies support small businesses, not disadvantage them, and then looking at this bill where we can thread the needle between helping local small businesses bring revenue back into our general fund, yet at the same time without poking every other state in the eye and inviting reciprocity and mutual assured destruction is, I think, very positive for us. So I really want to thank you again for bringing this forward. I thank all of the state agencies for the time it took for you to report on all of the different issues that we talked today. We're going to continue to get reports back in January, again, not to embarrass any of the state agencies or tell you that you're doing a bad job, but just to let you know that we want you to do better. And when it comes to the statutes and budget, if there are things that you recommend that we do that can help you do better, we want to know about it and be supportive. Anything else, Jen?
We're going to hear from Clyde.
Oh, yeah.
I'm fine.
If you've heard enough, I'm fine.
You thought you got off.
Chair Shields.
Thanks. And we do have two other people.
Members of the committee, for the record, Clyde Sackey, Oregon Department of Transportation.
I provided you written testimony, and I just wanted to touch on a couple of points. We're fairly new to the preferencing situation in Hospital 3000. One of the restrictions or challenges we face is federal procurement language that governs federal funds distributed through the Federal Highway Administration, the Federal Transit, Federal Rail. And so that's one of the things that we have to kind of grapple with as we look at preferencing language. But that being said, I think there's opportunity here, and Hospital 3000 gives us an opportunity maybe to see if we can be creative, see what flexibility we can find, see if there's places we can maybe push the envelope a little bit, because even though we have some of those restrictions, we know that the use of local goods and services really has a number of paybacks. Not just for ODOT, but for the state in general. One thing we can do, and we continue to try to do, is that even though we have some federal restrictions, we do our best and continue to try to improve our outreach. In other words, making sure that all Oregon businesses know the body of work that's available through things like ORPEN, trade shows, and those types of things, and we'll continue to do that. Also through some of our programs, providing technical assistance to contractors so that they can learn, if they're not already there, how to craft bids that have a high probability of success when they bid for jobs with ODOT. The federal restrictions, however, do not prohibit us or impede us in having preference language included for projects that are solely funded with state funds. So we are now working with DAS and with other agencies to set up kind of the framework on how we would implement that. We're also working on contract language that would allow the preferencing in projects that are solely funded by state funds where we don't have the federal restrictions. And again, we just think that the supporting of local businesses has a number of paybacks. It brings jobs and money back into the Oregon economy. We actually do see good prices from local vendors that we work with and contractors. And the other payback is it really helps us to meet some of our sustainability goals because of not having to maybe transport material and aids in our greenhouse gas emissions. So there's a number of different things I think that we look at that really are benefits to this besides just the direct economic benefit. So I'll stop there, and if you have any questions.
And in Hospital 3000, all state services and goods can be included except capital construction.
Capital construction, right.
Right.
Mr. Chair, if I might, one interesting thing that happened in the food arena that we might make a note to talk to our congressmen and women next time we see them, there was a similar federal prohibition on food food preferences in food contracting if you were going to use federal money. And about 4 years ago, Congress changed that to allow regional preferences with even federal tax dollars. So there's a little bit of a trend, at least, mm-hmm. that we might be able to talk to them about other kinds of procurement to authorize it, because the same exact problem existed. USDA provides most of the school lunch money. We were trying to do farm to school. They said, well, you can't really do that. And then the farm bill in 2008 said, no, actually, we will allow. It wasn't state-based, but it was regional. So you could say, okay, Oregon and Washington, we're going to use our federal money for just farmers from Oregon and Washington, and then we're going to use our state money for just Oregon and create a formula that works. So we should remind our, next time we see them, we should remind our congressmen and women that they could help in this category as mm-hmm. well on the transportation stuff.
Right. And what about materials for capital construction projects? Steel, Oregon Steel, things like that, can is that up to the prime contractor to procure those, and House Bill 3000 wouldn't affect, or?
I'm not, do you know, Diane? Churchill's, I'm not sure about that part of it.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I we haven't asked that question, so let me do some research and get back to Jan.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Absolutely.
All right, good. Well, thank you very much again for your testimony. Much appreciated.
Thank you for help squeaking the bill through. I remember I was going to tease a few of my colleagues, but they're not here. So,
all right, can we bring up Stella Transu, Tammy Dorman.
That's it.
And that's it?
Mm-hmm. Hello again.
Welcome
Stella Transu with Department of Human Services and Oregon Health Authority. So the testimony for the by Oregon is at the end of, is the last two paragraphs on my, the item that I distributed. I do want to tell you about the espresso cart, though, that generated some interest. So there were no bids for that. And we did, we've pulled that back and are trying to figure out what, what was the issue. And we did, the procurement staff did call some of the folks that expressed interest on Orpin, because you can see who looked at it. And it was some of the specifications. So the cart was to be used for training so that people could get some possible training on being an espresso, whatever those people are called, cappuccino.
Barista.
Barista, yes. So we're still working on that. So, but nothing, no cart yet, no cart contract. So we have used at Department of Human Services and Oregon Health Authority the language that the Department of Administrative Services, the State Procurement Office, developed. We've shared that with our procurement staff. And I think one of the things that Representative Clem said was we need to get the word out better. I mean, we've shared it with our folks and said this is a possibility, this is a may. I know that the Oregon State Hospital has used some of the language. The contracts that we execute, 86% of those are have Oregon addresses. Some of those I know are, you know, have out-of-state headquarters, but the vast majority of our contracts, because of what we need, you know, client services, they're done in the community, mental health services, things like that. So we have vast majority of Oregon contractors. But, you know, we can always do more, and one of the things that's on the next agenda for the program users group that we have is to talk about the possibility of this. The other thing that's important when you think about Oregon Health Authority and Department of Human Services contracts, a lot of them are direct negotiated, or, you know, they're the government entities that we're required to contract with. So we, of all of our contracts in a year, only about 5% actually are through a solicitation. Any questions?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Shields, a member of the committee. I'm Tammy Dorman from Department of Corrections. And mine also is on your document that I handed out before. So we've actually done a little bit. We've started to reach out to some vendors. You'll notice that one of those was ours, the flour. And actually the last three procurements that we've done for flour have all come from Pendleton Flour Mills. What we're trying to do is leverage some of our ability to maybe pick up goods, because we have trucks and warehouses. So as we negotiate some of these contracts in the future, we may say, you don't have to deliver it to us, we can pick it up. So we've been reaching out to some people like Lamb Weston that has potatoes, of course the Pendleton Flour Mills, Smith Frozen Foods has a lot of vegetables. We do buy a lot of food, and we have in the past, you know, our milk comes from Alpenrose Dairy, our eggs come from Willamette Egg. So we've been doing this, but now we'll do even more and we'll reach out. So just kind of a nice thing that we put on the bottom here, before this law even existed, and it just happened, they were the lowest bidder. We have entered into a contract for our inmate telephone services with a company from Ontario, Oregon. So it's a huge contract, and our contractor before this was always some big company from somewhere else. So we're very excited about that because of the customer service that they can also provide, besides all the economic development and everything else.
Who is that company?
They go by a couple different names, Telmate and what's the other one?
Pinnacle. In the OC world, that's called an alias, right?
But they, so all the inmates, you know, that what they are is the payphones in all the prisons, they will operate those. So it's a big, big contract.
Interesting. Okay. And it seems that the, I mean, your other biggest contractor, healthcare services, which I assume are frequently out-of-state companies.
So we have a managed, we have somebody who manages those, but like when we bring, but they work with, you know, providers in Oregon. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when we take someone to the hospital, it's usually in Oregon, except for like in Ontario, when you need to take someone to the hospital, sometimes they have to go to Boise because it's closer. But most of our providers that we bring in are from Oregon, even if they're managed by an outside company.
Is there a big healthcare management firm in Oregon that was competing with some of those outside ones?
I'm not sure. And that contract has several years left on it. So as this rolls out, we'll be able to look for some more opportunities.
Yeah, I'm not aware of any, but I was...
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not up on that.
Okay. All right, great.
Any questions?
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Thanks, everybody, for participating in this. I know you all are very, very busy, and it's an important topic. This meeting is adjourned.